This is the podcast where you can listen to my award-winning audiobook, But He Spit in My Coffee. I'm Carrie Williams, the author. Cindy Peller is our reader. If you haven't been with us since the beginning, I suggest going back to start with episode one.
81. I flip on the news. Over the sound of the running faucet, I catch snippets. AR-15. Students dead. School shooter. Parkland. Images of grief-stricken parents flash across the screen. As I watch students run on a sidewalk in front of a concrete school building, fear traces its icy fingers down my spine. "Mom, are we still going to see Devin?" Amias calls down from the top of the stairs. When I don't answer, he calls again, "Mom?" "Soon," I say, distractedly, sinking to the couch. The death toll is up to 17, and there's a suspect in custody. He's adopted. The pundits rail about the need for mental health treatment, missed warning signs, and parents not getting appropriate help for their kids. There's a whooshing in my ears. I want to pound my fists on the television screen. I've heeded the signs. Devin's been in treatment for years. He's had literally thousands of hours of therapy. He's only gotten more violent. More dangerous. The footage plays on a horrifying loop, and I can't look away for the longest time. Only reluctantly do I click off the TV. It's getting late. We need to go. The kids come down and pile into the car. Their chatter is like fuzzy background noise as I drive. The shooter's face flashes in my mind, and I shudder. Then it hits me like a bullet. For years, Devin has used whatever's within reach as a weapon. Books, trash cans, pencils. What could happen if a gun is ever within his reach? I wipe hot tears from my eyes, overwhelmed with grief. The scab on my heart tears wide open. I should have done more. Been a better mother, found a solution. And now, it's too late. I pull into the group home, climb the stairs, and ring the doorbell. Inhale, exhale. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The door swings open, and I hope that Devin doesn't notice that I'm forcing enthusiasm into my voice around the lump in my throat. "Happy birthday." "Hi, guys." A grin darts across Devin's face when he sees the presents Amias is carrying up the broken concrete walkway behind me. I'm holding him close in a hug. My heart beat against his, full of apology and regret. Devin pulls away. "Hey, Brandon, let me take those." He lifts the tray of vanilla cupcakes out of Brandon's hands. Mr. Robb waves us into the front parlor. "They're here for my birthday," Devin tells him. In that moment, he's the same giddy birthday boy he was a decade ago, back when the future had been so bright. That's when I believed all Devin needed was the love of a forever family. Now there's a ball of paralyzing dread forming in the hollow part of my chest. Kayla and Brandon sit on the threadbare couch. Amias leans awkwardly against a wall, rolling one of his shoulder-length dreads between two fingers. "I'll be back here with the other boys." Mr. Robb's deep monotone voice draws my attention as he starts toward the back of the house. "We need staff to supervise the visit," I remind him. "I'm the only one here this afternoon." I look into Devin's eager face, but I can't take the risk. "I'm really sorry, Devin, but we won't be able to stay without staff."
But,
"It's my birthday." His voice cracks with emotion. His shoulders slump. Turning to Mr. Robb, I ask, "Can you stay to supervise long enough to let him open his presents?" He nods. Pasting on a smile, I pat Devin's arm. "It'll be like when you were little, a speed birthday." His face brightens, and he tears the wrapping paper off of the first box. He pulls out a pair of white Adidas. He sits on a chair and shoves his bare feet into the sneakers, pacing to test them out. He grabs the next present. It's from Amias and Kayla. He unwraps a small purple box and turns it over in his hands.
What is it?
He asks. It's Bean Boozled, Kayla says. Amias adds, it's awesome. It's really gross jelly bean flavors. You can play with the other kids that live here. Devin reads off the box.
Rotten eggs? Boogers? Dead fish? Strawberry banana smoothie?
He wrinkles his nose and Kayla and Amias laugh. Just be sure to have a trash can nearby to throw up in, I say, handing Devin another present. Devin pumps a fist in the air when he sees that it's a remote control helicopter. Brandon jostles against Devin's arm.
Let's try it, he says.
Another time, I promise, stopping them from opening the packaging. Devin hands the helicopter to Brandon, who admires it through the windowed box. I hold out a shiny red gift bag with white tissue paper. This last one is special because you're a Valentine's Day baby. He pulls a heart-shaped box of chocolate-covered cherries out. He hugs it to his chest.
Thanks, Mom. I love it all.
Daddy says happy birthday. He wanted to come, but he couldn't make it. He's working, I say. Sam, too. He's still on base in Georgia.
Mr. Rob clears his throat. I gotta get back. We're not allowed to leave the clients unsupervised.
I gather the torn wrapping paper as Amias, Kayla, and Brandon wish Devin a happy birthday and head to the car. I stand on the stoop under the bright entry light, and Devin seems swallowed up by the gloomy hallway. Crooked in one arm, he holds the helicopter box, and his hand clutches the chocolates and jelly beans. If I could erase all of my mistakes and erase all of his hurts, he'd be just another teenage boy having a milestone birthday. Moving a step closer, I lower my voice to a whisper. You're 16 now. If you act out, they're going to call the police, and you could be charged as an adult. Devin nods, but skepticism fills his eyes. Desperate to get through to him, I look him in the eye. You've got to start making good choices. You're not a little kid anymore. I hug him once more. I love you. Happy birthday. Devin watches from the front stoop as I back the car out of the driveway.
Devin was almost crying, Amaya says. Don't you think we should let him move home? He's part of our family.
I flip the headlights on and they light a path forward through the night. He'll always be a part of our family. But this is his home for now, I say regretfully. Through the rearview mirror, I watch Devin wave goodbye. Tears gather in the corner of my eyes as he shrinks and disappears into the darkness. Grief, I've learned, is really just love. It's all the love you want to give but cannot. All of that unspent love gathers in the corner of your eyes, the lump in your throat, and in that hollow part of your chest. Grief is just love with no place to go. Jamie Anderson, As the Lights Wink Out. Epilogue. Our story didn't have to go this way. Devin came to us having been the victim of developmental trauma, chronic early childhood neglect and abuse, a pre-existing condition as real as diabetes or asthma. This is typically diagnosed as reactive attachment disorder, RAD, which is rare in the general population, but it's far more common among kids who've spent time in the foster care system. Developmental trauma impacts each child differently, and Devin is on the severe end of the spectrum. As a result, he had poor impulse control, impaired cause and effect thinking, and dysregulated moods. He also exhibited many of the extreme behaviors associated with RAD, including playing with feces, destructive rages, extreme manipulation, and lying and physical aggression. as Devin grew bigger, stronger, and more violent. We faced an impossible dilemma. He desperately needed to be part of our family, but he was becoming too dangerous to live at home. Unfortunately, after he entered a treatment facility at the age of 10, he was never able to safely return home to live. He lost 8 years of his childhood to institutions. This didn't have to happen. Like most adoptive parents, my husband and I jumped in heart first. The foster and adoptive communities have come to recognize certain behaviors as normal for foster kids, including hoarding, gorging, sleep disturbances, potty issues, tantrums, fear of being left alone, difficulty bonding, and more. Unfortunately, because these behaviors have been normalized, they didn't raise alarm bells during those early months with Devin and Kayla. My husband and I assumed, based on everything we were told from the child welfare professionals, they only needed stability and the love of a forever family. Traditional parenting methods never worked with Devin, but I forged on, knowing no better way. He was defiant and rebellious, but those characterizations didn't tell the whole story. Devin had picked up an invisible rope, locking us into a tug of war, and was clinging on for dear life. This is common for kids with RAD, who feel as though they must control people and situations around them because the world is unsafe. Not understanding this, I unwittingly played this game of tug of war with him. Looking back, I wonder how our relationship might have developed differently if only I'd been equipped to recognize what was going on and able to implement therapeutic parenting methods. For years, I was plagued with guilt, and I still am, for not loving Devin in the way that I wanted to. Our society views the judge's pen like a magic wand, and their signature on adoption finalization paperwork as some sort of enchantment. It's not. It takes time to build a relationship with your adopted child, and it can be extremely challenging if they have difficult behaviors. Further complicating things, Devin was actively thwarting our relationship through his behaviors, particularly his weaponization of his bodily functions, which he knew I was sensitive to. This is common for kids with RAD, because they don't know how to be in a healthy relationship, and they feel safer pushing people away. If I had known, it would have changed how I interacted with Devin and how I internalized his actions. Instead, he felt rejected and unloved. Devin's triangulation of adults was particularly difficult to handle. Kids with RAD are often superficially charming and adept at manipulating their fathers, teachers, and therapists. Family and friends usually side with the child in blaming the mother for his behaviors. The child with RAD sees the conflicts that he orchestrates as comforting evidence of his power. I did not realize that this was happening. If I had, I would have worked to educate my husband about the disorder and its symptoms instead of taking his dismissal of my concerns so personally. Exactly when Devin's tantrums morphed into rages isn't clear to me. I was so focused on making it through each incident that I lost perspective. This resulted in a calamitous delay in getting treatment, and those 7 years weren't merely wasted time and a delay in getting treatment. Every mistake and misstep that I made exacerbated Devin's condition and damaged our relationship. Meanwhile, my other children were being traumatized by the increasingly toxic situation. Devin's behaviors impacted his ability to function in school, make friends, and have a peaceful home life. It also caused significant primary and secondary trauma for Amias, Kayla, and Brandon. I knew that things were getting worse and something was very, very wrong, but I had no idea where to start with getting help. Had I known, Devin could have received treatment sooner and his siblings could have been protected earlier.
One notable clinician says that a telltale sign of a kid with RAD is a pissed-off mom. A spot-on description of me in those early years. Unfortunately, it didn't serve me or Devin well, especially when working with inept professionals angry doesn't work. I alienated the therapists, and Devin was able to triangulate between us. He was able to deflect attention away from himself and receive very little actual therapy. New Hope was not an appropriate placement, but we spent, wasted, 2 years there. They were never going to get it, and I should have moved on far sooner. Throughout all the facilities and treatment programs that Devin went to, we rarely encountered individuals who were truly trauma-informed. This is devastating, given that studies show that nearly half of all children in the United States have experienced at least one trauma, and 1 in 6 kids are diagnosed with a behavioral or a psychological disorder. In these programs, Devin did not receive specialized treatment for RAD. He was grouped in with kids who were suffering from depression, anxiety, and other disorders. Unfortunately, the treatments for these conditions are ineffective for RAD. For kids like Devin to heal, we must acknowledge the need for research and new treatments. Imagine how our story might have been different if Devin received solid, trauma-based treatment with a focus on functioning in the family. He might have gotten his driving permit at 15, gone to prom, played high school football, gotten a summer job, and graduated from high school with his classmates. All milestones that he missed out on. Devin has not had access to effective treatment and did not get early interventions. This forced us to make an impossible choice. For the safety of Devin and the other kids, we had to leave Devin in these facilities, even though he was not getting better. This is a choice that no parent should ever face. Yet so many do. When children with RAD become too dangerous to live at home for the safety of siblings, parents, and themselves, they are institutionalized or funneled into the juvenile justice system. Unfortunately, even with early intervention and treatment, kids with RAD may suffer the effects for their lifetimes and pass the impacts to generations that come after them. There are no quick and easy solutions, but I'm convinced that 2 very basic, common-sense solutions would have changed the outcome for Devin and our family. First, we needed comprehensive training about developmental trauma and therapeutic parenting. We needed to know the warning signs and where to go for help. We needed this before our family was in crisis. By the time a family is in crisis, it's too late. Second, Devin needed access to specialized, effective treatments to heal the brain trauma caused by his early childhood abuse and neglect. It seems unimaginable that adoptive parents don't already receive training, support, and resources for developmental trauma. It seems impossible that there aren't effective treatments for RAD. Yet sadly, this is why thousands of kids are not able to thrive in their forever families. In the aftermath of the 2018 Parkland school shooting, the most popular talking point, aside from calls for gun control, was the need for increased access to mental health services. I knew better. This isn't merely an access issue. The mental health system doesn't have answers. In fact, treatment centers are virtual incubators for violence, churning out angry, dangerous young people. The link between developmental trauma and violence has been known for decades. Psychologists Terry Levy and Michael Orlando made this correlation in their article, Kids Who Kill, published by the Forensic Examiner in the aftermath of Columbine. Levy published an adaptation of the article in response to the Parkland school shooting, where he noted the significant escalation in youth violence over the last 2 decades. After the Sun Sentinel published my op-ed, A Mother's Take, I've Tried the System and It Doesn't Work, an adoptive mother with a story like mine contacted me. She invited me to join her online private support group. In that group and several others, I found myself surrounded by a community of tens of thousands of parents with stories nearly identical to mine. Why have we been forced underground into secret parenting groups? Because when we do tell our stories to family, friends, law enforcement, educators, and mental health professionals, we are blamed and shamed into silence. As a result, our kids and families are not getting the help that we desperately need. This problem is too big for parents to address alone. We need the community to work together to advocate for better support for adoptive parents and specialized treatments for our kids. This is why I've chosen to tell my story. Through the pages of this Reads Like Fiction memoir, readers can walk in my shoes and begin to understand the complexity and nuances of these situations. Our story has been tragic, but that doesn't have to be the future for the thousands of other children with developmental trauma. Their future has not yet been written.
We've come to the end of my audiobook, But He Spit in My Coffee. Thank you for taking the time to listen. I hope my story has been thought-provoking. If you'd like to help raise awareness, a good first step is to share this podcast. You can also find more information on my website, raisingdevin.com. Here are some FAQs that may answer some of your questions.
What gives you the right to tell Devin's story? I don't have the right to tell Devin's story, and I am not. I am telling my story, the story of how I adopted a child with RAD and my struggle to navigate the child welfare and mental health systems. As part of sharing any experience such as this, there is always the intersection of the stories of other people. As a society, we routinely discuss the experiences of caregivers, caregivers to the chronically or terminally ill, to aging parents, to children with autism, to babies born prematurely, and to those with a myriad of other special needs. The experience of parents like myself, caregivers of children with RAD, needs to be told as well. Did you receive Devin's permission to publish this book? Devin has given me permission to share and publish what is contained in this book, and he is benefiting financially from it. There are situations and events I have not included in this book at his request. Furthermore, I have chosen to exclude details that are unnecessarily gratuitous. Ultimately, though, this story is not about Devin. It is about how the system is failing our most vulnerable children and the families that care for them. Why are you disclosing Kayla's sexual orientation? Kayla specifically asked me to include the details that I have in this book. She has been open about her sexuality for several years and hopes that our story will encourage parents to be supportive of their LGBTQ+ children. Is Sarah okay with you telling this story? Sarah has consented to my sharing how she lost her children. She believes, as I do, that many birth mothers unfairly lose custody of their children when they should receive services and help. Sarah is one of the most honest and courageous women I know, and I am honored to be able to speak up on her behalf about how she was victimized by the system. Don't you realize you weren't a good mother to Devin? Of course I realize this. I deeply regret my inability to be the mother Devin needed. I hope my honesty and transparency in telling this story will make clear that mothers of kids with RAD are being asked to do the impossible, and our best is literally not good enough. By blaming and shaming moms, child welfare and mental health professionals have been able to deflect away from their lack of effective treatments for RAD and other outcomes of early childhood trauma. As a result, our children and families are not getting the help we need. Isn't RAD a fake, defunct diagnosis? Currently, reactive attachment disorder is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, as a real diagnosis, alongside other mental health disorders we are familiar with, like bipolar, ADHD, and schizophrenia. The DSM is the standard classification of mental disorders used worldwide by mental health professionals and the health insurance industry. That said, there is much debate about the RAD diagnosis, in large part due to harmful attachment therapies associated with it in the past. Leading clinicians and researchers are promoting a shift towards developmental trauma disorder, DTD, as a more comprehensive diagnosis for the impacts of early childhood trauma. Unfortunately, this was submitted for consideration as a new diagnosis in the most recent version of the DSM and was rejected. While I strongly support the move away from RAD to DTD as a more helpful diagnosis for our children, in this book, I factually document the RAD diagnosis my son actually received from clinicians and psychiatrists. What happened between the end of the book and when Devin turned 18? Due to Devin's age and dangerous behaviors, it became increasingly difficult to find facilities willing to treat him. This was especially true when he began to get charged with misdemeanors and felonies. Ultimately, a facility filed a health and safety discharge, which enabled them to discharge him without securing a new placement. This meant he was being discharged to home. They contacted me with an ultimatum. They would withdraw the health and safety discharge and keep him if I would pay them thousands of dollars out of pocket, under the table, and in addition to the Medicaid payments they receive. As this was my only option to keep Devin and his siblings safe, I made the payments to keep him in care until he turned 18. What's your relationship with Devin like now? When Devin became an adult with real-world consequences and responsibilities, he began making better choices. Also, our relationship was no longer hostage to the dysfunctions of the system. I no longer had to fear Devin leveraging false allegations against me, and the police would come to my aid if necessary. As a result, my relationship with Devin is on a path of healing. We have talked about what has happened, and I've apologized for not being able to be the mother he needed. While nothing can ever make that right, I think Devin is coming to understand some of the why. Where is everyone now? Devin is working to integrate into the community and to mitigate his outstanding criminal charges. He loves video games, anime, and animals. Kayla is a young adult and is exploring potential career paths. She likes to skateboard, rap, and spend time with friends. Sam is working as a self-employed barber. Amias is serving in our military as an aircraft mechanic. Brandon is in high school and hopes to become a veterinarian. Delano passed away in 2019. Becky and Jason and I continue to go on vacations together with all the kids, now young adults and teenagers. We still celebrate holidays together at Auntie Becky's house. What does "based on a true story" mean? Most importantly, it means that the substance of this story has not been fabricated. However, in order to write this as a reads-like-fiction narrative, I have taken non-material and other liberties. Dialogue has been reconstructed based on my recollections, the recollections of others, my journals, and other documentation. In addition, names and personally identifying details have been changed in most cases. What documentation did you use while writing this book? I leaned heavily on my own extensive journals and contemporaneous notes, as well as the recollections of others. I also relied on thousands of pages of formal and informal documentation I have collected over the years. When I began this project, I also requested records from the professionals and facilities our family interacted with to supplement my documentation. Did therapists really say those things to you? Many of the interactions with therapists that I've described in this book may be surprising or even hard to believe. However, these interactions did happen, and I was able to very closely and accurately recreate the dialogue based on my contemporaneous notes and documentation. As other moms of kids with RAD will attest, this is the unhelpful advice and guidance therapists provide to our families. This is why developing effective specialized treatments for RAD must be a priority. Why can't I find any of the facilities named in this book? Most names of facilities and people, as well as identifying details, have been changed. This book is not intended to be an exposé of any specific organization or person. It is intended to be an exposé of the systemic failures and dysfunctions of the child welfare and mental health systems that are not adequately supporting children with RAD and their families. Why did you write this to read like a novel? The lives of moms of children with RAD are unimaginable for those who haven't experienced it. I wrote this story to read like a novel to enable readers to experience for themselves the struggles and nuances of a family in crisis and see for themselves the shocking dysfunctions of the systems that are failing our children and families. My hope is that the community, therapists, doctors, mental health professionals, educators, and others, will gain a newly informed perspective to begin to rethink their assumptions about our families. My hope is that our family and friends will get it and begin to offer us empathy and support. My hope is that everyone who reads this book will become an advocate for the child welfare and mental health reforms our kids need. Why did you use the stages of grief to structure this book? C.S. Lewis wrote, "I sat with my anger long enough until she told me her real name was grief." Writing is a cathartic experience, and ultimately, it was how I sat with my anger and became introspective enough about these events to understand my own feelings. I realized that I was grieving for the unfulfilled expectations I had for myself as a mother and the unfulfilled expectations I had for adoption. Do you still support adoption? Absolutely. I believe adoptive parents should keep jumping in hearts first, but also eyes wide open. This book was not written to discourage anyone from adopting. It was written to support adoption by highlighting where the system needs to change to better support children and their families so adoptions can be more successful. A note about active shooters. In the interest of telling this story accurately, I included the conversation I had with my kids about the Batman shooting, true to what I said at the time. However, I've since learned from active shooter training to run if you can, hide and barricade if you cannot, and fight back as a last resort. Please educate yourself and your kids on how to stay safe. Where can I learn more about your story? You can find links to my published articles and interviews, as well as my blog posts, on my website, www.raisingdevon.com. I've also posted an album of pictures at www.raisingdevon.com/album. Where can I get help? If you are caring for a child who has a history of early childhood trauma, there are online support groups and several organizations that can provide you with information and help. You can find these resources, as well as my articles and blog posts, at www.raisingdevon.com or find me on Facebook at www.facebook.com/raisingdevon. My book, Reactive Attachment Disorder, The Essential Guide for Parents, is available on Amazon and Audible.